ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
ABC Cricket Podcast time with your boys, Corbin Middlemass and Ed Cowan, at the completion of the Boxing Day test after 2 days, 5:24 local time, 6 minutes before the scheduled stumps time, just over 141 overs, we're done. 36 wickets fell. England winners here by 4 wickets. It's their first win on Aussie soil in almost 15 years. Oh, we got a lot to pull apart. My name's Corbin Middlemass, still at the mighty MCG as the Aussie boys are out there at the moment with their families. At the end of the test match, at the end of the second day, Ed Cowan is my podcast co-host, former Australian opener in Sydney. Hello, Teddy.
Corb, you sound a little shocked. It's as though you didn't believe me last night when I said England were a decent chance of winning the game. They'll get the best of the batting conditions.
Replayed it this morning as part of our coverage on Grandstand Cricket. Thought of you at the end of play. All over it, Teddy. And here we are at the end of the second day and the test is over.
Give me the feeling from the ground. Take us there for a moment.
Deflated, would be the word. And not, I mean, it's hard because England win. I think a lot of us sort of, you don't want to be accused of, you know, sour grapes and, you know, you sort of, but it's not so much about whoever won the game. It's more about the fact that it was a 2 day test match. And it feels like you don't want to sort of rush to that conversation without giving England their flowers. So we might start there and we'll get to that. But I think there's a sense that, yes, it was, you know, a lot happened, but I mean, people watch test cricket for the balance between the contest between the bat and the ball. And we didn't get that here. We saw the ball completely dominate the bat and ultimately we saw a procession of wickets and people, I think by and large, felt like this isn't what they signed up for. This isn't the game that they love. And it felt like a completely different version of that.
Yeah, it felt dissatisfying. And I'm going to put the result to one side. And maybe this feels against maybe what I said at the end of the Perth test where maybe it was off the back of the Travis Head innings. It was something remarkable that my excitement levels and, you know, the fact that I felt like I'd been entertained, where this, I think, deflated is probably closer to my overarching emotion. And congratulations to England. They totally outplayed Australia, I thought, today. And yesterday was probably a toss of the coin. But that feeling of just wanting something more, some things in life are best enjoyed slowly. You know, a nice meal, you know, a slow-cooked lamb. There's other things in the world. But when you sizzle it on the barbecue, it's not the same, is it? And it's kind of nice for a bit, but it doesn't have the same emotion carried with it as something that's stewed with love. So I'm probably feeling a bit the same. There were pockets where I thought, oh, this is kind of interesting, but I don't know. A two-day test ain't it, that's for sure.
Yeah. If you like his stats, there's a whole lot of those. I mean, like the Perth test, highest total in the match was the fourth innings. So England obviously winning by 4 wickets to run them down. Harry Brook there at the end, but they got it done by committee. Jacob Bethel, the top scorer, with 40. If you look at the previous two-day test matches in Australia, so 1931 was the last time it happened in Melbourne. That was 94 years ago. So first time we've had that in Melbourne since. But you go from 1931 two-day test match all the way to 2022, that green monster in Brisbane against South Africa. And then we've had two in this series alone. So Perth, three test matches later, we get one here in Melbourne. It's the first time in almost 130 years of test cricket, any series anywhere in the world that's featured two-day test matches in the same series. I mean, one, it can't be good for Cricket Australia, and we'll get to the ramifications of that shortly. But that just goes to show, I guess, how rare an event this has been. But maybe it's a, you know, what do they say? Twice is coincidence, three times a pattern. Is this a sign of what's to come?
I mean, potentially. And last night, I think we described it as 60-40 wickets to skill. I actually thought today was inverted. I thought the batting skill on display was almost contagious following on from the England innings. Australia batted as poorly as they have for a long time. And it's been a batting lineup that has probably papered over some cracks in the last few home summers between Travis Head's brilliance and Steve Smith at times. But I don't know. People will gravitate to the wicket. It looked at times a pretty decent wicket. It was probably three quarters of a day underprepared. Yeah, and I conceded to you last night. I was like, oh, you know, maybe you'll take the points today. I kind of feel a little bit vindicated in my view. What we didn't see, any tactical nous around, for instance, hey, the 5 meter length is a really tricky length to play because it's hitting my stumps and it's challenging both heads of the bat. Why don't I bat a meter out of my crease rather than trying to walk at bowlers and, you know, playing the ball on the move? Why don't I start out there and take their length away and make the keeper come up, which takes incredible skill in and of itself. And maybe to Nessa and Boland, that's possible. Definitely not to Stark and definitely not to, you know, to a Cass who gets the bounce. So for instance, let's bat a meter outside our crease. These guys aren't bowling except Stark, incredible pace. And then when the keeper does come up, why don't I bat right back on my stumps and give them an extra meter length that way? And just find ways to manipulate. I'm going to bat right across my stumps to play the ball under my eyes more. Maybe I'll bat way outside leg stump to cut the ball a bit more. There are ways that you can manipulate length without running at the bowler and trying to hit it over the head, or batting on your crease and prodding, or pushing at a ball and you nick it to slips and you walk off feeling aggrieved. So we didn't see a lot of, I don't think, tactical problem solving in the moment. And maybe that's the modern game and, you know, blah, blah, blah. So I thought the batting was really poor today. We didn't see guys leaving the ball well on length. You know, Weatherall did it a little bit and then, you know, a moment of indecision, he got unlucky. But leaving the ball and being happy that it goes over the top of the stumps at times. And, you know, the good leave is often better than the tentative push. I don't know. Yeah, maybe you can respond. I was frustrated with our efforts with the bat. Maybe it was different live. I obviously wasn't there.
Yeah. I don't know. I feel that the Test cricket's facing so many challenges as it is. Like, and then we're going to produce, you know, pitches like that, for example, that I feel like it doesn't help the modern player. And so we're sort of yearning for the modern player to go back and hone their craft and their technique. You got to remember there's a format of the game nowadays that we've been playing for 20 years that they've eradicated the forward defense. Like that is not a shot in T20 cricket. And that's where all the money is. That's where they play the majority of the year. And then, you know, here we are in Test cricket.
Not the majority of the year. So I get your point and I agree with it. And I agreed with it last night. There are incentives to rewire your technique to play more attacking cricket. But let's incentivize people to be specialist four-day players. If we crave for four-day cricket and five-day cricket to go a little longer, obviously the wickets can be flatter. But
to play against who?
Well, to play, like, this is a far,
what, India and England
this is a,
or whatever.
This is a far and bigger they, discussion. I don't disagree with this. I'm just saying there are ways and means to pick teams, to prepare teams. I think you're right. And I think I'm right, and I think we both can be right to a degree that, yes, this wicket was too extreme, but I also think it's a bit of a cop-out for players to say, oh, that's the modern way. Well, it might be the modern way of white ball cricket, and as we know, that's where guys get paid. They get paid a lot of money to play Test cricket, don't you worry. And so, I don't know, maybe it's my frustration coming out. Maybe I'm getting long in the tooth. So I think there's some middle ground here. For sure, but what I didn't see was any great batting, and we actually saw England apply themselves in parts, and the irony of winning the game in singles when they pushed the field back.
Bethel batted beautifully. It felt like he was one that made the adjustments, and Harry Brook really in both innings. I know I said I was going to start with England, but we're sort of down this path on the pitch here. So Matt Page is going to do media tomorrow morning. Ooh. He obviously spoke leading into the test. I mean, you can imagine they'd be getting a million phone calls from every journalist basically saying, hey, can we chat to him again? He said leading into the test match, he'd found the perfect recipe. Last year's pitch against India felt like it was the best one that they'd prepared, and it went to the fifth day. All four results were live as we entered day five last year against India. He also said, you know, last year's pitch had 7 or 8 mil on it, and then this year had 10. And obviously we saw what happened. It's all over in 2 days. He was just out here with his ground staff moments ago. How would you handle that? I mean, you've got the players coming out in the press conference, in the post-match presentation, basically saying, hey, this was too much in favour of the bowling team. Even if you feel like that there's a part that it's, you know, modern batting techniques, is it for the curator to come out and say that? Like, if you were coaching him from a PR point of view as to how he handles that press conference tomorrow, other than falling on his sword and saying, hey, we got it wrong, we got a pretty good track record over a long period of time. Like, what would you say?
Well, much the latter. And by the way, my previous diatribe was not saying that the wicket was a great cricket wicket. It was a poor cricket wicket. It was, so let's assume that to be the case. If I was Matt Page, I would come out and say exactly what you just said. And this is a guy who does have an incredible track record. He turned this wicket from a turgid dump to probably the best cricket wicket, or maybe the best cricket wicket in the country, on par with Adelaide. And the last couple of test matches have proved that. And so I think in these situations, you put your hand up and said, you know what? I got it wrong. I thought X, Y, and Z. It didn't play out. And, you know, if this means I lose my job, so be it. But I'll just implore the powers that be that, you know, part of the reason why this wicket is as good as it has been the last couple of years is because I was willing to experiment. We could have kept doing the same thing. And we saw a Shield game, I think, 2 years ago. Everyone had an absolute panic attack.
That's right.
2 games before the test. And he said, hey, just trust me. I'm just seeing how far I can push this wicket. You know, what does 12 mils of grass do? And it was carnage, you know, much more than what we saw in this test match and far worse bowlers. So this is a guy that has been pushing the boundaries. He pushed it over the edge, and he'd be silly not to acknowledge that.
Yeah. I mean, that massive ramifications. I mean, you're our finance guy here, Teddy, as well as our former pro cricketer. But, you know, there's a figure that's been thrown around by some, you know, media outlets of $10 million. I mean, I imagine it would be hard to quantify the actual figure. And then there's an ongoing, you know, knock-on effects of that when, you know, the next time they sit down to do a television deal, for example, and they've, you know, essentially sold an Ashes series expecting, you know, if it's not 25 days, it might be 21 or, you know, 23 or whatever it turns out to be. And instead it's, you know, it's 13 days of a possible 20 at this particular stage. Like, the next time they go to negotiate all these things, it's going to be a pretty tough conversation. So, as much as, you know, Matt Page, I'm sure, will be feeling it tonight, that there are, you know, administrators, and the knock-on effect of this happening is considerable.
Yeah, it's short-term pain and long-term pain, as you've just described. So I don't know what the exact number is. You know, we heard 5 in Perth for the lost day of day 3. You can kind of do some maths and say that holds, what, 60? MCG holds 90. So on the short term, I don't know, maybe it's $8 million, $8 or $9 million. 10 seems too much, but, you know, it's all too much at this point in time. So there's some short-term pain for sure, but you're right, when they come round to the broadcasting deal, which is a fair way away, mind you, and Test cricket, you know, at this rate might look totally different, full stop. So I think the best thing that Cricket Australia can do in the very short term, every single one of these squad members gets back and plays for their Big Bash team in the next round. You say, fellas, you've had 2 days of cricket. Let's do the broadcasters a little solid here, and you get back and you play the next round for your Big Bash teams, because at least that way they will feel like there's a partnership of some description. The Sydney Test isn't for what, 4, 7, 8 days. That is miles away, and so they're going to be home. Some of them, you know, might be on the road, but so be it. That's part of the naughty boy premise that you got to put up with.
Mm-hmm. Even leading into a test match wouldn't bother you one bit.
I mean, you can't have it both ways and say, oh, modern day techniques, it doesn't really matter. They play T20 cricket anyway. It's not great preparation for a test match. Well, I didn't see great preparation for a test match here if you're going to go and poke at every ball.
Ben Cameron reported today that there was a prominent Victorian who was working behind the scenes and pitching to Cricket Australia and television outlets about the possibility of some kind of an exhibition game. I mean, you cast your mind back to the early 70s, and really the launch of limited overs cricket started in that fashion when a test match was washed out here at the MCG, and they ended up playing an organised 40-over game on what would have been, you know, one of the later days of the test match. I think there's a fan day that they've organised tomorrow, for whatever that's worth. You get the chance to meet the players, and they're going to do that out the back here at Yarra Park. So the Aussie boys will be there. I don't know what it'll mean for the England guys, but Cricket Australia, I guess, trying to do their best. And I think this is a lessons learned from Perth, for example, thinking, you know, what can we do in the event that people feel like they're shortchanged by the Australian Cricket Roadshow coming to town?
Yeah, I mean, I don't mind that idea. It's just, it's basically impossible to pull off. So good in concept, hard in practice, I'd say.
Yeah. Yeah, I don't mind your idea though. I think that's a good one. Stuart Clark asked Steve Smith about a post game on Grandstand Cricket, and he essentially chuckled and said, "Oh well, we'll see what'll happen. I'm sure the phone will ring, so we may just see it yet, given the extra time off that the guys have." The match itself, so the fallout for the two teams. I just want to start with England here before we drill down on the Aussies and how they'll debrief this. I mean, these things have the ability to break one or two ways when you're 3-0 down away from home. And then all of a sudden, you know, the tabloids pick up, you know, exactly what happened in Noosa. You saw how emotional Ben Stokes was in the way that he addressed exactly what had gone on there. And you thought, gee, all these elements coming together doesn't necessarily sort of lend itself to a response. Sometimes it does, you know, backs against the wall type effort. But even when they were 42 down on the first innings and all out for 110, you thought, gee, this is, you know, the whitewash is well and truly on here. And from that position, Teddy, they pull off a near 15-year first. I've got the exact number. It was 5,468 days since their last win in Australia, going back to that famous 2010-11 team down here. And they win a test match away from home. Does it ease some pressure on England and particularly the top brass?
Well, it eases them very momentarily. I think, you know, the fallout will come after the series. And if they lose in Sydney, to me, 4-1 is not particularly very different to 5-0. If they can, you know, win in Sydney and all of a sudden 3-2, and if they win well, you know, there's probably some, you know, understanding of what happened around preparation, and they can dig into that. But they'll probably say, you know, the style of play and the captaincy and the coach is good enough to then, having won, you know, two tests on the bounce, having not won one for, you know, 5,400 whatever days. So I think it's still up in the air. I'm not prepared to call that just yet. We saw some bright sparks. You know, you called out Jacob Bethell. You know, I was probably a big proponent of him starting the series. He's looked a good player despite not having necessarily a record, but sometimes you just need to back these guys in. He looked as comfortable as anyone, really. You know, we saw Cass come alive. We saw Zach Crawley today have moments. You know, the disappointing thing for Australia was England were a bowler down. Gus Atkinson went down with a hammy, and they actually capitulated after that, not before that.
Yeah, correct. Didn't feel it at all.
So, you know, there'll be questions, but I think, you know, there aren't many answers from an England point of view. I thought they were better. They caught a bit better, but I think it kind of got handed to them on a plate, didn't it?
It was a big I mean, it's a monkey off the back. I mean, the New Zealand, I think, had the equal previous longest dry spell here, which was also 18 tests. So if they'd lost here or, you know, didn't get a result, it would have been the longest winless run in away from home in sort of any country in the world that this team would hold. So the fact that they broke through and win here, and great reward for the Barmy Army. We talked about them, and that they should be given like a medal, shouldn't they? And Jim Maxwell spoke about this off-air with us the other day, but think about the amount of money that these guys tip into Australian tourism. And to have them down here again and the atmosphere that they provide, talk about India never playing an away game. Well, England's the same thing, the way that the Barmy Army travel. And so if nothing else, it was nice for them to be able to have a day in the Aussie sun and get the chance to celebrate.
Corb, I think you've been drinking the Kool-Aid a little bit, mate. Have you ever done an English winter? So you can either sit at home and watch the Premier League in the snow, or you can come down to Melbourne for a Boxing Day test. Sure, it's expensive, but, you know, I think it's amazing that they travel, but I don't think we need to go too over the top, do we?
Jeez, it's easy for you, Teddy. The common man has to put a lot of money together for something like that. Just on Joe Root, so we spoke to him post-game, and it was awesome to be able to chat with, you know, one of the all-timers. 18th test match here, first time he gets a win on Australian soil. So he's never won a test match here previously. Ben Stokes in his 13th test, same deal. It's a fascinating series from a Joe Root perspective, where you look through it and it's not as if he's got sort of big gaudy runs he ticked the box with the 100 in Australia, albeit it was a test that they lost, pink ball under lights, and we know your comments at the time. And then he gets his first win here in Melbourne in a fast test match, which is all over inside 2 days, in what is essentially a dead rubber. And you think, I guess if nothing else, you can't say, look, he doesn't have a test 100 in Australia, and you can't say he never won in Australia. But, it probably wasn't the fashion, I'm sure, that a lot of people drew it up when they thought, oh, Joe Root's going to go down there and prove all the knockers wrong. It wasn't that kind of a hasn't been so far that kind of a series for him.
No, it hasn't. And, you know, he would be pretty disappointed with the output, really, for someone that came in relatively good form, and particularly over the last 2 years, been the dominant player in the world. Hasn't really looked like getting going at all. Australia have had great plans and executed well, and he hasn't responded or been able to respond. So, you know, minus that 100 in Brisbane, he hasn't really threatened. So, look, we'll see what happens in Sydney, but you'd probably give him a B minus, I reckon, for the tour so far. I mean, if that was a win, we can get excited here or not excited. The series is done. The Ashes is lost. It, you know, got served to them on a plate, you know, winning the toss and bowling. Australia then played incredibly poorly. So we can try and kind of dig through the England response, but, I'm kind of pretty even keeled here.
I'm happy to leave it there and move on to the Australians, and I think that segues beautifully. How do the Aussies debrief this, and how much of this is exactly what you just spoke about? The Ashes are retained. It's Christmas time. Everyone's had a fill-up. Everyone's pretty happy with how things are going, and then essentially you get put on a really difficult wicket, and even if it's 5 or 10% in the subconscious where you think, gee, this is pretty hard work, and you kind of – there's just that in the background that – you know, we love to say there's no dead rubbers in Test cricket and all the rest of it, and no one's going to cop to that. But there has to be an element, doesn't there, in the background that, all of those elements rolled together.
Yeah, I mean, perhaps. I think it's hard to say that they weren't hungry to win the Test match. They looked hungry, but things went against them. I think their debrief will be more woe is me than, fellas, we need some proper time in the mirror and examine what happened here. I think they'll move on pretty quickly. But if they were serious, if you go through all 20 dismissals, Travis Head got a ripper of a ball. There were some other good moments of bowling, maybe Mitch Stark today. There's some pretty poor execution and a few moments of misfortune as well. So I think there are more questions probably for Australia being thrown up than England, usually the way when you lose. But the team looked out of balance. I think we learned a little bit about Jai Richardson and that selection probably looked underdone. I don't think he's in the team to bowl 130, little sweatband seamers. That ain't his job. So I think the selectors will probably put a little mark next to his name and put a watch on that. I think, you know, is there a watch still on Khawaja? Who knows? I'm kind of sick of trying to predict what they're trying to do around Usman. I think the one name that you illuminated is probably Cam Green, because he looks kind of what cricketers would describe as in the bush. That's when your mind is elsewhere and it's scrambled, and, you know, he didn't bowl today, for instance. So if he ain't bowling, it's a hard spot to nail down in the team. It's a tricky one, that's for sure. But I think they'll come back strong. I'm pretty firm on that.
So obviously no Cummins and Hazelwood for the remainder of the series. Boland and Stark have done a mountain of work, and lion-hearted performances the whole way through. Nisa was very effective, particularly in the first innings here, and it was obviously a good pitch for him. Let's leave the bowlers to one side. But we're talking about this in the lift on the way back up, and you look at Australia's top seven at the moment, you think there's probably only three there that you'd be getting your chisel out and absolutely locking them in. Like, you know, Steve Smith's a star, Travis Head's their best player at present, and if it's not Travis Head, it's Alex Carey. Yeah. And then apart from that, there's probably four guys there where you go, well, has Jake Weatherald made the spot his own? Usman Khawaja's 39. He's now a middle-order player, albeit he was the only guy to face 50 balls in the first innings for Australia. Then you work your way through. You mentioned Cam Green. And the last guy that I haven't mentioned there is Manus Labuschagne, who Has attracted a bit of attention too. He's got that second innings 50 in Perth, and that's really it. It's the one signature score for the series so far.
And that's probably the name that has probably flown most under the radar. This is someone that had five domestic hundreds to force his way back in the team. But over the course of the calendar year, I think I saw a stat, you know, only three people in the history of Australian cricket batting in the top four have ever had a worse average over a calendar year or something to that effect. And so it's been a poor year and we came in with high expectations. But we know, you know, and we've had this conversation a million times, Australian cricket's in a better place when he's in the team and scoring runs. So it will turn for him at some stage. It does look as though all those little gains that he made in domestic cricket have kind of unraveled a little bit. I don't know. You've seen the games live, but, you know, where he was assured with his footwork leading into the Test series and we saw in Perth and in Brisbane, the last two tests has been far less assured in my mind. We're back to kind of half steps and not transferring weight and hands out in front and nicking off. So, you know, there's going to be question marks, but, you know, it's for me, it's still probably at the moment, Green and Khawaja, whose names will keep coming up. I think it's hard to, in a series like this, to judge Weatherall. I'm not saying they won't or they haven't in the past. But, I think for the moment, when you get picked, you should get somewhere between 5 and 8 tests to prove your worth. So, yes, the number will come up at some stage. It will need to get some runs, but it ain't just yet.
So this is why I find the timing fascinating, which leads to my next conversation, particularly around those four guys, right? And I asked Steve Smith this actually post-game, and he looked at me and said, look, that's a good question. I haven't thought about it, and I'm sure we'll discuss it at some point. How do they approach Sydney? Is Sydney the last stop, the end of the line? Let's just get through and worry about the next series when it rolls around, knowing that there is a near 7-month gap from the test match that they play in Sydney through to the next test that they play, which is going to be in August against Bangladesh. Or is it, let's find something out here and then take that into this 6.5-7 month hiatus? It's just going to be a fascinating wait. And then they get to Bangladesh. And then when it starts, it's on. It's 2 against Bangladesh. It's 3 away against South Africa. 4 back home against New Zealand. Then it's the one-off test against England. It's over. Sorry, then it's 5 away against India. One-off test against England. Overseas to play England. So it sort of feels like then it happens fast. And these are sort of banner series. So how do you work out, particularly around those four guys, as to who's it and who's not? Is it just a matter of going back to Shield cricket in the new year? Is it, we're trying to work that out in Sydney? Are guys playing for their spot here? Or do all of them just, get carried over because of the long absence and that they just get the benefit of the doubt when we roll up and play Bangladesh in August, which feels like another world away?
Yeah, and I've probably struggled to get in the minds of the selectors in the last year and a half, that's for sure. I've had some views that probably haven't been in line with how they've seen their team come together. So a few things on my mind specifically as it relates to the future. One is there has to be a line in the sand after this series because, given what you've just outlined in terms of the next 2 years, you want to start building for those big series. So India away, England away, how are we starting to build our team? And it probably shouldn't look anything that it's currently looking at, just given the age profile of the team. And so there are very few opportunities as an Australian selector when a big series is won and you get to learn something about someone. That is a once in a blue moon event. Probably every 4 years at the end of an Ashes series, and we've seen it before, someone gets picked that, you can learn something about. And so it might be a Cooper Connolly to come in and bowl some left-arm spin and bat. I don't know. I'm throwing a name out. Maybe we learn more about Bo Webster. But there are certain names that you wouldn't be just letting them slip through a series, not play, then expect them maybe to turn up in Bangladesh, maybe to go back to Shield cricket. I'd be utilising the opportunity because selecting is about shaping the future, not the past. And they got to start shaping the future. You can't be living in the present forever because we will be digging a huge hole for Australian cricket if we kind of keep thinking that specifically.
I'd love to know how that Bangladesh team is going to be picked. That would, because you think, I mean, that's going to be in the top end. So there's going to be a game in Darwin. There's going to be a game in Mackay. You think there's going to be the chance to score a few. It's then going to lead into, you know, a number of glamour series. So everyone's going to be racing to obviously get a start at that particular stage. But apart from the IPL and maybe if you've got a county gig, you know, no one's going to be playing any cricket in the lead up. The last first class game here is going to be played in March. The last test match is going to be played next week, and then that's it. So they're going to come out cold into that series, and then from there it's she's on. The revenge tour of South Africa and back home against New Zealand and everything else. So it's an exciting time for Australian cricket, but there's at least four guys in that batting lineup in the top seven that have a lot to play for in Sydney, that if you come out and score some runs there, that you think, you know, you're an incumbent, and that'll get you a start for the Bangladesh test in August, and you're away from there. Yeah. Teddy, we'll talk more about it, I'm sure, on Monday on our extended edition. Given the fact there's only 2 days of cricket, we thought we'd give you at least half an hour of cricketing content here on the ABC Cricket Podcast. It's meant to be our daily wrap, but it's felt like a big picture test, didn't it, as people sitting there watching all the wickets fall, that they were thinking about the game from a zoomed out lens. So we thought we'd hit on a bit of it here on Stumps on day two. And Stumps on the test match, she's all over. England by 4 wickets, Australia 3, England 1 in the series. I will chat to you on Monday as we pull apart everything else going on in the cricket world.
Thanks, Corb. I think on notice, you need to get all the notes that we pulled out before the Ashes, and we can go through and maybe just see where we're sitting.
Okay. Well, a little bit of a review of our predictions. We'll see how we go.
Get people excited for the fifth test. We need something to play for.
Sounds good. I'll chat to you on Monday, Teddy.
Later.
Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.